Hello, listeners. So today's podcast is an interesting conversation, and I want you to ask yourself this question as you progress through. Does the person that Todd is talking with like him? Think it over. I think it's kind of an interesting question. And the answer is, yes, I think he likes me. But it's always kind of this weirdly awkward conversation. And it's because I think fundamentally one of the basic premises that we're going into, this idea that there is a discipline of safety science, is in question. Because when you ask them, what is safety science? People tend to say, well, it's an amalgamation of sociology, engineering, psychology, and resilience studies. Well, so that's not a science. That's an amalgamation of all those things. It should be a category unto itself. But that's just my opinion. I don't want to bias you, although I totally did because I started with this conversation. But you're going to hear that topic come up because today we're going to talk with one of my favorite people, Drew Ray. Now, years ago, and I think it probably is years. So I've been doing this podcast, I think I'm really close to 10 years, which is unbelievable. Drew actually had a podcast before this podcast called Disastercast. And I don't know if you've heard it. You can still find it, and it's worth listening to. And what Drew would do would be to give a context-rich description of a disaster. And then in the podcast with some thought-provoking questions, some kind of discussion questions. They were great. I mean, they were great. They were amazing. But because Drew's career started to consume him, because he's a professor at Griffith University, and he's a busy person. And because they were quite a bit of work in the old days to do podcasts like that, now it's much easier. Now there's all these great pieces of equipment that are developed just for podcasting that kind of do everything. I mean, it's way easier now than it was 10 years ago. That podcast kind of fell aside. It didn't go away, but it fell aside. I hear that it may reappear. That's gossip. It's only gossip. You can't swear on that because it's not true, but it may come back. And that would be very cool. That would be so cool. This conversation is a great one. So Drew has been around a while and we've known each other for a long time. It's only a second time we've presented together, or maybe third time. But it was great fun. How are you? How's everything going? The weeks keep clicking by, click, 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 which is great. That gives us lots of good things to think about and talk about. I hope you're seeing deliberate improvement and strategies and fun, and you're developing people along the way. Do all the good stuff you can do. I mean, why not? Why not have a positive impression on the world? It seems like it's as good a thing to do as anything else that I can think of. As for me, life just keeps chugging along, baby. That's what's going on. I'm trying to change things in my life, but changing things is hard because you can't change behavior by simply asking me to change behavior. So my behavior won't change just because I want my behavior to change. I've got to change more than just my behavior. And that part is hard because I don't know if you've noticed, but gravity sucks pretty hard. And once you're doing something, it's easier to continually do it than to change it and not do it. I don't know. I think I need somebody behind me with a hot shot. You guys know what a hot shot is? It's a little thing that shot you poke in the back of like cattle. I don't even know if they use these anymore. It seems like they're probably inhumane and they give a little tiny electric charge. It's not dangerous. I have been poked many times with a hot shot and it kind of encourages you. Through Skinnerian behavioral manipulation to move faster. It's very Skinnerian. when you think about it. But I need somebody behind me kind of poking me. That would be a good thing. Not punishing me, because punishment is not a very good deterrent. In fact, punishment's a horrible deterrent. And we really need short-term change deterrents if we're going to have, because long-term has no impact at all. I like the idea that you don't work twice as hard to do things differently. You work twice as hard to remove the barriers that are not allowing you to do them. So that's a much different way to look at it. Instead of motivating yourself twice as hard, you actually remove the things that are keeping you from doing what it is you want to do. It works pretty well. I mean, it's a good idea. You know, high value items should be easy to see, but it should take some work to get them. Those kind of things. It's all part of the big overall behavioral hoo-ha that we talk about. Let's get into the podcast before I get much farther on this philosophical bent. I clearly started this place in a funky position. Why not just end it in that same funky position? Listen to this conversation. I think you're going to love it. It's a couple of old friends getting together once in a while, having a conversation that we haven't had in probably 6 or 7 years, for sure. Not since the pandemic. And we want to bring you along. So sit back and relax and listen as Drew and I talk about the future of safety as it moves forward throughout the globe. So it is really funny that your introduction was Drew makes people uncomfortable when they meet him, because that is a little hard to follow. But I thought you handled it brilliantly. I mean, why not? When given lemons, make lemonade. And you handled it beautifully. So the presentation was great. I'm so curious on your journey, the need for the empirical sort of evidential journey. Why there's so much silence around other fields? And let me own that for you, because I think it's a great question for you. You'll love it, or I hope you will. There's a lack of evidence that zero stops reporting.
Yep.
Except if you go to the management journals, you'll find voluminous evidence on the danger of chilling effect. And one could make a very easy case that zero creates a chilling effect. I mean, have you thought about that in that way? Is the evidence from management journals not valuable or interesting? And the quick answer is it might not be interesting. I'll give you that right away.
So much stuff in safety is trying to translate theory and evidence from management or social psychology, because we're not willing to do our own homework. We want to copy from someone else's homework.
Yeah, but generally within the academy, it's not only okay, but kind of often valued to not copy off other people's homework, but to actually use the scholarship of people who've walked before. So for instance, you're really good about this, so it's hard to pick stones, but for instance, Sydney dogged non-safety scholarship by quoting both Ev Rogers and Thomas Kuhn.
Yep.
So which is, I mean, both great. I mean, Ev Rogers was my advisor, so I'm very close to that. And Thomas Kuhn is Thomas Kuhn. But it doesn't seem like you can have both. You can't say there's a lack of evidence, except that this evidence exists to prove that.
Okay. So Two separate issues.
Yeah.
One of them is translatability, which is you need to be really careful about this. Does this actually speak to the situation speaking about?
Right.
And that's always a judgment call.
So, well, or part of your RQ. I mean, that's definitely a part of your research question. Fair enough.
Yeah. You know, just sticking safety on something doesn't make it a different research question.
Right.
But it can sometimes, depending on, like, you know, I don't think it's a stretch to say, okay, we've done research on stretch goals in other research. Zero harm is just an example of a seemingly impossible goal. Does this translate? Whereas the chilling effect stuff is not directly.
But it's not directly.
Exactly. So there is a judgment call there.
Right.
The other one is just about research quality, which is always easier to evaluate in your own field than in other fields.
Right.
And some safety people are much more willing to just cherry pick and say, okay, we got this management literature that says this, so it must be true. And then you go and look at the literature, and the study they did wasn't even a study. It's actually just someone pontificating in an academic paper.
Which there's much of. Yeah. I mean, completely. I mean,
you mentioned Thomas Kuhn. Thomas Kuhn is not an empirical researcher.
No, he's a
philosopher.
He's a philosopher of research. Yeah. I mean,
so, you know, he's not going to give you useful empirical results that you can translate into safety.
Right.
He's going to give you big ideas.
But you also can't then use Thomas Kuhn to justify a lack of empirical results. Exactly. That's, I mean, the question I wanted to ask more than anything today, but it was too inside baseball. I mean, you would love it and we'd have a great discussion, is the absence of evidence evidence of absence? I mean, which is the most trite thing. I mean, Drew, if you pushed me, I don't know if you could think of a more, there is a more trite thing. If I'd have said at the end of the day, that's the way it is. That's more trite.
I think it's a genuinely fair question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same argument that you have if you're an atheist online talking to
kind of
religious people. Which
wow, is, that's a really good analogy.
Where does the burden of proof sit? And I would say that at the point where you've got a practice or a policy or something like zero harm that's been around for years and years and you're pushing it, at that point, the absence of evidence in its favor is damning because it was your job to know that it worked before you did it. Or right. At least to the first time you did it.
Right.
Measure by the 50th time when you're advocating that other people do it, when you're making your subcontractors adopt it. If you don't have evidence by that point, the absence of evidence is evidence of your own ethical failings. If you're criticizing something, it's a little bit harder. You know, I'm very happy to say that if you're pushing zero harm, you should have evidence. I have no problem criticizing you for lack of evidence. But if I'm going to make active statements in the other way, if I'm going to say zero harm suppresses reporting or like specific criticism like that, then I probably need to have direct evidence of those harms as well to make those specific evidence-based criticisms.
And so therefore you do a direct study.
Yeah.
Those studies aren't being done.
Well, no. And that's where I guess it's like whose obligation is it? Because if I don't like zero harm, I'm not going to research zero harm just in order to prove that you shouldn't do zero harm. You know,
right?
We can't test every theory.
Well, and the risk is you research zero harm and you find out that it works, so then you have to stop your entire career and sell your consultancy or whatever the case is.
Well, that's why I take the approach that I take to evidence, because my career is not in jeopardy.
Right. No,
my career doesn't come from saying zero harm is bad. My career comes from saying we should study the evidence. So if evidence actually works and we manage to produce evidence that changes minds, then that's good for me.
Right.
That just means we should do more of the collecting of evidence because it shows that we need evidence because our intuitions aren't working.
But when you do research design, so when you guys, you pick up a project or you guys think of a great project and you do that research design, why isn't there more deference to, for instance, the canons of sociology? I mean, we're still dealing with humans. We're still dealing with human systems. And there's tremendous amount of studies. One of the things that drives me crazy, Drew, is people who act like they've invented the word culture because they're in safety. When there's a tremendous amount of data around culture. I mean,
okay, don't get me started on culture.
Me too.
I am so with you there.
Yeah, we could go for hours, but.
And yeah, this is the other thing we do in safety is we take these ideas that originate outside safety. We stick safety on them.
Right.
We don't think it's special because we think we can just adopt the idea without doing research ourselves. But then 20 years later, we think it is special because it's got the word safety on. And we're ignoring all the other research about culture because safety culture is this different right. special thing that we never properly conceptualized or researched.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And it's even almost more egregious if it could be. And this is pretty egregious. And that is where they act like they invented it.
Oh, yeah.
Like this is, you know, well, we just figured this out. Well, no, you didn't just figure it out. People figured that out long before you.
So this is academic inside baseball, but the easiest way to make a career for yourself as an academic is to find an idea that's well established in a general field, introduce it into a specific field such as safety, and claim credit for the whole idea.
Yeah.
No. There are dozens of careers built on that exact approach.
How much love do you get from the community for the work you're doing?
Very little. In part because what I do is I research safety practice. And the outcomes of researching safety practice are most likely to be negative, in the sense that they are at best freeing people from doing things that don't work. And it's a little bit like helping someone with their job by adding AI. You free them from burdens, but what they see is the risk of losing their job.
Yeah, oh, completely. It could not be a more timely example than that one. I mean, that's amazing.
They see the disruption. They see the challenge to their value. And for people who are genuinely curious or already frustrated, that's liberating. And they love it. For people who have got so much identity built up in particular ideas and particular approaches, they see it as not just challenging their ideas, but challenging their identity and their value. And that gets really quite like hurtful and hostile.
Well, I agree. And egos right now, and my guess is if you look at the developmental arc of a sect, S-E-C-T,
yep,
my guess is that you would find sort of a section developmentally where egos really matter. Who's first? Who said it? Who owns it? I'm also guessing eventually that will go away. But currently, we're really in a position where those things matter. They seem to matter a lot. And so that sort of notches up the emotionality of all the arguments. I mean, people are genuinely hurtful. I mean, I think you're right.
This is a difficult conversation to have with you because you're inside the loop. You're one of the players in that game as a spreader of ideas.
Mm-hmm. And also other diseases.
Let's stick with spreader of ideas. And particularly if you are seen to be getting personal benefit or reputation or authority from an idea, then there is going to be contest about ownership of the idea. Personally, I don't care. Because for me, it's not about the ideas. It's about the evidence behind the practices. So you and people like you and Sydney are objects of my research. You're not sort of playing the same game
right, that
I'm playing. I'm interested in how do those ideas spread? How do people adopt them? Why do people not translate from this challenge to current practice? Why does that not translate into evidence-based practice? Why does it translate just into this cult-like switch to new behaviors that are now unstable because they don't have a strong evidence base?
But quite predictable.
Oh, yeah, predictable.
I mean, it's sort of how change happens.
Yeah. History doesn't repeat. It just sort of has these constant forces that materialize at particular places.
And we know from history, it's a very good teacher, that people really don't make a lot of empirical-based decisions. They make a lot of emotionally-based decisions. But empirical decisions are actually kind of a struggle. I mean, you have to work really hard for them, and they're not incredibly convincing. In fact, one of the most interesting things to me is how people can simply ignore evidence. They just, they see it, but it's just as if it's not there.
The most fascinating thing I have researched was take fives, because I came into it with this theory that you could reduce safety clutter by substituting the paperwork with evidence that you didn't need the paperwork. And I thought, okay, if you've got evidence that you don't have to have it, that would liberate people to get rid of a practice that they hate. And the company that invested so much in doing the research didn't want to hear the results.
Sure.
So many people in the company wanted to get rid of take fives, but sort of as a social mass, they didn't. And that like undermined the whole business case for doing the research. Fascinating. I love doing it as research, but as a like, how do you improve safety in your organization if evidence that something doesn't work doesn't free you to change?
Well, and the challenge is, because this is a really interesting point to me, the challenge is that so much of operational reliability or performance or whatever term your industry wants to use is really based upon this notion that you're confident enough to believe you can do it well. And that's a very, very difficult thing to measure. I mean, the challenge is that you're in a field and you picked it clearly because here you are, where there's just not a lot of evidence.
and where evidence doesn't matter that much.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a little bit intrigued by, there are professions that have actually managed that transition. So you've seen something like medicine go from something that was highly individual to something that was from start of education right through to end of career, very much for better and worse, structured around generalizable evidence.
Evidence-based medicine.
Yeah.
Which, you know, if we had medicine people in this room, they would kind of be rolling their eyes right now.
I do understand that. I mean, that's a whole extra layer of critique once you get that far.
Right.
But you've got to get that far first to even have those arguments that they have. You know, something I was talking about the other day was that social psychology is having a massive crisis because their experiments don't replicate and they don't know when right. they do and don't generalize.
Right. I mean, you're right.
We haven't got remotely that far because we don't even have the experiments.
No, but you're exactly right.
Worrying about that.
So, but what about like chaos physics? How much far have you, what's the word, dove? What's the past tense? Dived? Dove. What is the past? I guess it's, let's go with dove. How far have you, it's not dove. How deeply have you gone, there we go, into this chaos physics stuff? It's, which is super interesting. And I can't believe you're not like completely enamored by just the.
It's a recipe for frustration to know too much physics around sociologists.
Which is true always.
Because they abuse every single physical term as an incorrectly applied metaphor.
Oh.
Starting back to Charles Barrow and coupling.
Oh, you're exactly right. Complexity. Well, in fact, I was going to tell you the funniest thing to me was when you put your equation up. Your slides are beautiful. You're such a good presenter that if you'd have put that slide up in a room full of physicists, I can't even imagine how fast they would take you down.
Oh, I mean, I was cringing as I wrote that slide because I wasn't getting.
I mean, that you would be karate chopped. I mean, they would just be like, what are you doing? You have no right to use that. I mean, they would just take you down on it.
Yes, I felt uncomfortable myself. But yeah, once you start talking about like complexity, chaos, quantum, and misusing those concepts,
yeah,
that is bad.
The chaos physics stuff is really interesting in that it's much more, the word I would use is not a word they would use, but it's much more pattern-based or conditioned-based. I don't know what word is better. It's very, very interesting physics because it's really coming off, and this is my definition, but it's kind of coming off sort of an applied use of quantum thinking. And they've come up with this idea of this notion that the universe is chaotic. I think people probably think that. I don't know if they have much evidence for it. It seems like it. But this idea that you can recognize patterns is really, really interesting to me.
Yeah. And sorry, I don't want to go too much down into the precise detail, just in case we've got physicists listening.
I'm sure we will have physicists listening.
But, you know, one of the things we depend on when we do research in anything is the fact that even though there is so much dependency on local detail and local conditions for what actually happens at work, we depend on the fact that at a higher level, patterns do emerge
right.
that are generalizable, that we can make definitive statements right. about and translate from situation to situation. Which is why I, who know nothing about anyone else's work, can come in and say, okay, you're the expert in your work, but I've still got something to offer because
right.
I've studied lots of people's work.
Right.
And I know that some of the things you're experiencing, other people are experiencing, and some of the solutions that work for them will work for you too.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not an expert in your work.
So imagine then that the notion of generalizable patterns or trends, which we've always looked for, that's always been really valuable. Imagine moving that towards more specific and specific. It's a really interesting idea. I mean, and what I think it draws to, the reason I even bring it up with you is because I think it draws to really the where you synthesize.
Yep.
Which is synthesize.
Synthesis.
Thank you. This is hard for me. Of multiple fields. To me, the one question I would ask you, and I mean this in the most loving way, is there really is no such thing as safety science. That term's made up.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean it in a loving way. I don't, by no ways, I'll say other offensive stuff, but this is not what I'm wanting to offend.
It's kind of a contradiction because you try to explain what safety science is and you immediately say it's a multidisciplinary field of study.
Which immediately de-cues it from science.
Yeah, which means that actually you got to have multiple disciplines. What are those multiple disciplines? Because safety science ain't one of them.
Yeah.
It's the multidisciplinary intersection.
Right. And go ahead.
So we have this contest all the time at like, what is the journal of our field? What it's supposed to be doing? Because there are so many different people trying to publish so many different things. Like, you know, I think that all safety science should ultimately be about studying and improving safety practice. But that's just like one pinpoint out of dozens of other views about what safety
maybe
science
hundreds,
should be all about.
Maybe hundreds of others. But that said, or yet that said, is probably a better way to say it, so much crap is being published.
Oh,
I mean, you and David speak of, I mean, I look at research legit. Well, I don't know if legit's a word. I look at published research from safety, and oftentimes these journals, a lot of them are pay to play journals, which really has some ethical questions about it as well. The research design is just, it's just not very good. I mean, I don't know how to say it other than it would probably keep you up at night because it's certainly not empirical.
Yeah. Even without the pay to play, the incentives towards publishing still skew towards both bad research design and bad filtering. Sid and I once tried to start like a journal club just for our students. It's a good practice for.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
And the trouble is every single session degenerated into Sid and I just ripping apart the methodology of the paper we were trying to study. Dave and I cherry pick like what we think is a good and interesting paper and still accidentally go on these detours attacking the methods every episode just because the overall level of quality is so
Is that a lack of peer review?
It's a lack of expertise in peer review and it's a lack of willingness to say no. When someone's devoted a year of their life to doing work, to act as gatekeeper and say this is not worthy even of being shared with the world is not a good thing to do.
Yeah, not fun.
There's not value in that sort of gatekeeping. The value is in finding the good stuff, not in preventing
the bad stuff. But I don't even know, and you probably know this, I don't even know where there is a peer-reviewed journal in safety. I mean, I don't even know where to go for that. Near as I can tell, and I could be wrong, and I'm glad to be wrong on this, I don't think there is one.
Oh, I mean, Safety Science is a good journal. It has highly variable peer review practices.
Yeah, which is a really
associate editor you get.
Beautiful way of saying there is not peer review.
Oh, no. Well, who do you call a peer? Do you call the master's student who's got time to dash off lots and lots of peer reviews peer review?
But I mean, that's a problem that other disciplines have solved. I mean, there is a definition of what a peer is. There is a definition of what a good peer review looks like. I mean, we don't have to go far to find that. We just haven't found it.
Other journals and other fields are less multidisciplinary, which means that there's a smaller set of good research practices to coalesce around and peer review around. They do say suffer the same problems in software engineering research, in that there's just so many different disciplinary practices. That, you know, one moment you'll have a quantitative study coming in, the next moment you've got a demographic study.
Yeah.
And how do you establish standards for what is a good paper? What is the minimal acceptable set of practices for that paper?
Well, I think it maybe goes back to my original question is, does a multidisciplinary field that calls itself safety science actually get to have a peer review journal? Because it's a multidisciplinary field. Should they be part of sociology when it's a sociological study or economics, it's an economic study or whatever the case is?
So there's two different practical answers to that. One of them is if we tried to do that, our stuff doesn't get published.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
In part because it's not good enough, which is embarrassing, but also in part because it is seen as too specialized.
Yeah.
And the other thing is we're all talking towards the same object in the same field. And again, I would argue that ultimately we're trying to improve safety practice. And so when we talk about publishing, it's not about speaking to sociologists. It's not about speaking to social psychologists. It's about putting research about safety in a place where people who want to know research about safety can find it.
Right. but there aren't even that many degree programs. This is a really interesting topic because I think it's growth pains. I think it's that arc again that we're in a position where as our profession becomes more defined, whatever that means, and I really don't know what that means, probably some of these questions will go away. What do you see as the future? What do you see in the next, I don't know, how far ahead do you look, Drew?
Personally, I make 5-year plans and okay. change after 3 years.
Yeah, okay, that's perfect. What do you see in 3 to 5 years? What do you see is, what should we be attuned to? Where are you going to focus your attention so that we know where to focus our attention?
Okay, so I can tell you directly where I'm focusing my attention right now, which is I'm dissolving our safety research team and replacing it with a digital transformations research program, where safety is just one aspect of a much more coalesced around particular methods and strategies and platforms for understanding how organizations and communities are struggling and adapting with technology change.
Nice.
And so it's doing exactly what you said. It's putting the safety bit subservient to the common set of research methods and questions to operate more within a community of researchers who are in the same direction. What I see happening more broadly, and this is not a good thing, is safety struggling to exist in universities to find its place and role.
Yeah.
And so long as we're all precarious, we're all really trapped into the perverse incentives of publishing bad stuff, having industry projects that are for the money rather than for the partnerships. And I see that continuing until we get to the point where the profession as a whole is much more willing to be sort of academically rigorous as a profession, not just as a researcher.
Yeah.
I mean, there are great clusters, like the stuff Matthew Hallowells is doing in the Construction Safety Research Alliance. That's a beautiful model of how you have a industry-led community, which is in partnership with researchers, where the whole community is interested in answering questions and being somewhat rigorous.
But it's pay to enter.
It is pay to enter.
And it's rather dear.
So, yeah, also in personal plans is try that just with smaller table stakes.
Oh, no, I'm for it.
make it cheaper to enter.
Yeah.
So that it's not only like big companies with big money. You chip in a little bit and you chip in your own time and interest. So we get people who are not just interested in paying for research, but people who want to be part of research. Right. And then instead of being money, they're giving some of their own time and their own like organizational insights.
And so Matthew's, I like him a lot. We're good friends. But to me, the intersection, and this is, I think, a huge kind of unsung part of what we've talked about, the intersection between really social sciences and engineering has created an incredibly interesting chasm.
It is uncomfortable and it is fun when you turn social science back onto the practice of engineering.
Or when you turn engineering, when you introduce engineering to the practice of social science.
Well, it's funny you say that because I am the one engineer in a department of humanities, arts, and social science. And my mission this year is to help redesign the Bachelor of Arts to make it a useful and defendable degree. So you want to make humanities relevant? Call in an engineer. You want to make engineering make sense? Call in social scientists.
It's true. Well, Godspeed, Drew. Thank you, man. This was great.
Thanks, Doug.
So what do you think? I told you. That was super interesting. I mean, that was a super interesting conversation. And listening back to it, there's a lot of love there. I adore Drew. I think he's great. He likes me. We had fun. It was a good way to start the podcast, though. It did kind of set it up so there was tension. And tension's always interesting. I'm over time again. Sorry. I promise I'd try not to do this. You'll make it. I promise. It's not that big a deal. It's only 5 minutes. Until then, learn something new every single day. Bet you did today. Have as much fun as you possibly can. Be kind to each other. Be good to each other. And for goodness sakes, you guys, be safe.